Okay, let's unpack this. We're about to start a deep dive into some source material that presents a legal challenge. So fundamental that if its arguments hold up, it's not just suggesting policy changes. It asserts that the vast majority of the modern American federal government is, well, illegitimate.
It's a really aggressive legal argument. I mean, it challenges the entire paradigm of how we even think about constitutional power. The sources are taking a very textualist approach. They draw on foundational legal thinkers to argue that there have been these systemic, century-long violations. And that means most federal agencies, statutes, and even our financial mechanisms aren't just unconstitutional, they're totally void ab initio.
Void ab initio. And then that means void from the very beginning, as if they never even existed. So that's the core mission here for you, the listener, to really get a handle on the legal and philosophical machinery that supports this claim of total nullity. Our sources, they're rooted in natural law, the writings of Blackstone, Locke, Bastiat, and also some classic American legal treatises by people like St. George Tucker and Thomas M. Cooley.
Yeah, and so we're examining this claim that the Constitution is not some living document that's meant to evolve with political whims. No, according to this analysis, it's a non-negotiable fixed contract, or as the material powerfully puts it, it's a highly precise cage designed to tie down government agents, you know, to keep their power strictly limited to that written charter.
The stakes here are just immense. This deep dive really forces us to confront a foundational question. What happens when the agents of the government systemically violate the written instructions that were given to them by the sovereign people?
To understand this void ab initio doctrine, you know, within the source material, you have to first accept the premise that the founders were operating on. They didn't view the Constitution as the highest legal authority.
And that is such a crucial distinction. We're talking about what the sources call the unbreakable hierarchy or the firewall. To begin, we have to grasp this idea of the pre-state foundation of rights and what government's sole purpose actually is.
Exactly. So before any state was established, before any constitution was ever written, there was what the Declaration calls the laws of nature and of nature's God. This philosophical commitment, it really anchors the entire structure. The sources, they draw immediately on William Blackstone. His commentaries on the laws of England were, I mean, they were indispensable to that founding generation.
Yeah, the material quotes Blackstone. He says the law of nature is superior to any human law, binding all over the globe in all countries and at all times. And then comes the critical line. No human laws are of any validity if contrary to this. So that means if Congress passes a law, but it violates a higher moral or natural principle, by definition, it's invalid.
That's the entire firewall in a nutshell. It means rights are not political gifts.
Yeah.
As Thomas Paine argued, and the sources lean on him heavily, rights, life, liberty, property, they're inherent rights. They're pre-state, pre-legal, and pre-political.
I think the clearest explanation I've seen of this comes from Frederick Bastiat in The Law. He kind of flips the script on how we usually view government. He said that life, liberty, and property didn't exist because men made laws. No, it was the fact that they existed beforehand that compelled men to make laws in the first place just to protect them.
Right. And if the rights exist prior to the state, then the government's only legitimate purpose is incredibly narrow. Bastiat calls government the collective organization of the individual right to lawful defense. So if I have the right to defend my life and my property, I can delegate that singular limited right to the common force. That's it.
It's the ultimate constraint, isn't it? If an individual can't lawfully steal from their neighbor or assault them, they can't delegate that power to the government to do it for them. The government's sole object is just to secure and protect those rights that already existed.
Exactly. And the sources cite the Alabama Constitution, Article 1, Section 35, as a perfect distillation of this idea. It says that the sole object and only legitimate end of government is to protect the citizen in the enjoyment of life, liberty, and property. And when the government assumes other functions, it is usurpation and oppression.
Wow. That one line, when the government assumes other functions, it is usurpation, that defines the entire critique of the modern federal state that follows. So the consequence of deviation has to be absolute.
Yes. When government exceeds this defensive sphere, when it uses that collective force for anything other than protection, you know, say redistribution, industrial control, whatever, Bastiat labels it perverted law. It becomes an instrument of plunder.
And this is where the source material brings in Thomas Jefferson's warning. He argued that the Constitution, it has to be the chains that prevent government from becoming what he called the legalized version of criminals.
Uh-huh.
The deviation itself, the very moment the agent exceeds the charter, it results in a kind of structural violence against the people. Okay, so let's nail down the specific structure of this legal theory. We have this unbreakable hierarchy, the firewall, with four very clearly defined levels.
You can think of it like the source code of a computer system. The higher levels just cannot be modified by the lower levels. Level one is the highest authority, law of revelation, God's law, the infinite moral authority.
And level two.
That's the fundamental maxims of law. The legal philosopher Edward Coke described these as eternal, self-evident propositions that can't be disputed. You know, the core inherent rules of justice. Things like the law can't compel someone to do the impossible. These maxims existed before any state, and they apply universally.
Okay, and only then, at level three, do we finally get to the constitutions of society, the U.S. Constitution itself.
And that's critical. Because, as the constitutional scholar Thomas M. Cooley emphasized, the Constitution is man's written cage, a limitation placed on government agents, and it must bow to the higher law of nature and those fundamental maxims.
Which leaves level four as the enactments, so statutes, codes, administrative rules. This is the stuff Congress does.
Right. Cooley defined these as merely the will of the legislature. They're temporary, and they're always subject to the maxims, to reason, and most importantly, to the express limits of the Constitution. If any enactment violates level 3, 2, or 1, the void consequence is absolute. The act is void from its inception.
This foundational belief, then, it leads directly to a complete rejection of modern constitutional interpretation. The sources are absolutely resolute on defining the Constitution as a fixed, non-negotiable contract.
The rule of law requires certainty. For the authors of this material, the document is just not a living document. That idea, they argue, it transforms the Constitution from a fixed anchor into just arbitrary political preference.
James Madison is the key authority here. The material uses his very sharp warning. He said, "As soon as the mind begins to deviate from the strict letter of the parchment, it is no longer a constitution. It is a scheme."
Think about what that really means. Madison is saying that the moment you interpret words beyond their fixed original meaning at the time of adoption, the contract is broken. Cooley affirmed this fixed rule. He said the meaning is fixed at the moment of its adoption and is not different at any subsequent time.
I understand the desire for certainty, but if you abandon that fixed standard, what does the source material say is the result?
Well, it leads instantly to the rule of man replacing the rule of law. If the Constitution can mean whatever a judge or Congress says it means today, then the law becomes arbitrary. Liberty becomes precarious because you can't possibly know the rules you have to follow. Locke's famous dictum is central to this. Wherever law ends, tyranny begins.
And this is exactly why the concept of legal nullity is applied so aggressively.
Precisely. If an act exceeds this fixed contract, it's not just subject to judicial review. It is void ab initio. The sources cite Norton v. Shelby County from 1886, a foundational Supreme Court case, and it affirms that an unconstitutional law is as inoperative as though it had never been passed, end quote. So the core legal claim being presented here is that the federal government, by operating outside that 1787 fixed contract, is basically resting on centuries of inoperative imaginary law.
Right. So if the Constitution is a fixed contract, the next logical step has to be defining the nature of the power the contract grants. Part two here focuses on delegated authority, which the sources define very strictly as a limited trust, all of it stemming from popular sovereignty.
This is that critical American idea that all political power originates with the people. Thomas Paine gave us the essential dichotomy. All power must be either delegated, which is a trust, or assumed, which is usurpation. There's no third option.
So if Congress acts without a specific delegation of power, it's not just a policy choice. It's an act of usurpation against the ultimate sovereign.
Absolutely. And this requires strict accountability. As Madison said in Federalist No. 45, the powers of the federal government are few and defined. Congress, therefore, has no reservoir of general power. Every single act must be traced line by line back to an express delegation in the text of the Constitution.
This reliance on the fixed text, it lets the source pivot and critique the modern judicial system itself. Specifically, it tackles the Supreme Court's assertion of interpretive supremacy, which was established back in Marbury v. Madison.
And this is where the material introduces some serious friction. It argues that this idea of a judicial review challenge, where the judiciary claims the exclusive and final power to determine what the Constitution means, it contradicts the very doctrine of the separation of powers the U.S. structure is built on.
How so? How does that claim of judicial supremacy contradict the separation of powers?
Well, the source cites the Massachusetts Constitution of 1780, which was a huge influence on the U.S. model. It explicitly mandates that no branch shall ever exercise the powers of the others. To the end, it may be a government of laws and not of men. The argument follows from there. When the judicial branch asserts an interpretive supremacy that creates new binding rules that aren't in the original text, it is, by definition, performing an act of legislation.
So the very act of claiming ultimate interpretive authority is itself an assumed power, a usurpation, because the people never delegated the power to the judicial branch to legislate or to rewrite the terms of that fixed contract.
It's a structural loop, you see. The judiciary can't just grant itself a power that the Constitution withheld. If the Constitution is fixed, then the check on Congress is the text itself, not the later subjective approval of the Supreme Court. The duty of constitutional compliance rests primarily with the legislative agent, with Congress.
Okay, let's move to the practical constraints. To reinforce this limited trust, the source material lays out the five immutable rules of delegation. These are common law agency principles that bind Congress as the people's agent. And if Congress violates even one, the statute is claimed to be void ab initio.
These rules are all about making sure the agent never exceeds the principal's authority.
So, rule one, limited source. What does the agent inherit?
It's the principle that you cannot grant what you do not possess. The source uses a text called Shepherd's Touchstone. A man cannot grant a thing which he hath not. Since the sovereign people only possess rights to life, liberty, property, and their lawful defense, they can't delegate powers to regulate private conscience or create arbitrary wealth transfers. Any statute that tries to do that is void because the power never existed in the delegator to begin with.
Okay, rule two. No redelegation, potestas delegata. This one seems to target the modern administrative state head on.
Oh, this is maybe the most devastating rule for the modern system. Potestas delegata non potest delegari. Delegated power cannot be further delegated. The people delegated the legislative duty exclusively to Congress in Article 1, Section 1.
Okay, let's use an analogy here just to make it really clear for you listening.
Think of it like a will. If a grandparent names their oldest child as the executor of their estate, that executor can't just turn around and hand all the decision-making authority over to some financial firm or a committee. The power was delegated specifically to that executor. And the source argues that Congress, by creating all these federal agencies, the EPA, FDA, SEC, and giving them the power to write operative rules, has violated this immutable rule. These agencies are legislating, but the people never delegated that power to them.
Which means the rulemaking power of every federal agency is potentially nullified from the start. What about rule three? No exceeding scope, non potest exceder.
Non potest exceder terminus potestatis suae. Derivative power cannot exceed the original grant. It's a fundamental tenet of agency law. The agent, Congress, can't perform an 18th power if the people only delegated 17 enumerated powers. This is just the common law restatement of that strict enumeration Madison defined.
And rule four, express exclusion, inclusio unius.
Inclusio unius est exclusio alterius. The inclusion of one thing is the exclusion of others. So if the document grants the power to regulate commerce among the several states, it automatically excludes the power to regulate non-commerce or activity within a single state. Power that's not expressly granted, it just doesn't exist. It acts as a hard boundary.
And finally, we have rule five. Constitutional silence is prohibition. Casus omissus.
This one really solidifies the strict approach. Cooley asserts that the silence of the Constitution is prohibition. If the document is silent on powers like establishing a central bank, creating a national police force, or mandating health insurance, that silence is a deliberate jurisdictional withholding. It's not an invitation for Congress to fill in the gap.
So by this framework, any attempt by the federal government to justify its actions based on implied powers or emergency necessity fails instantly. It violates the written contract and these agency rules.
Absolutely. The source concludes that deviation isn't just an error. It is, in the words of St. George Tucker, an act of treason against the sovereignty of the people because the agent has broken that most fundamental trust.
We've set the firewall. We've defined the rules of agency. Now we're getting into the heart of the operational critique. The clause-by-clause dismantling of modern federal authority, strictly adhering to the 1760s, 1780s definitions of the words in Article 1, Section 8. This is where the rubber really meets the road.
This is the most detailed part of the source material. It argues that modern government has, well, it's essentially redefined every critical noun and verb in the Constitution to seize power it was never given.
Let's start with a big one, the source of almost all federal social spending. Clause 1, the general welfare fraud.
The text grants the power to lay and collect taxes, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare. And the contention here is that general welfare is habitually and intentionally misread.
Well, in the modern context, we often read general welfare as this broad grant of power to spend money on anything that seems beneficial, right? But what was the original intent?
The sources, and they cite Madison in Federalist Number 41, they argue unequivocally that the general welfare clause is a limitation, not a grant of power. It restricts the purpose for which taxes can be collected, namely, to pay existing debts or to provide for the common defense. It does not allow Congress to just legislate on any issue touching on the general welfare. It only permits taxation for that very specific purpose.
So the strict constructionist test is simple. Does this tax money pay a debt or literally defend the nation against attack? If the answer is no, the tax itself and the spending it funds is void.
That's the severity of the claim. If this strict definition holds, vast swaths of the modern budget are immediately rendered void ab initio. The sources list examples. Social Security, as a national insurance scheme and wealth transfer, fails because it is not common defense. Medicare, Medicaid, Department of Education grants, and student loan forgiveness all are cited as programs outside of debt service or literal defense against invasion or insurrection.
Which means every single federal dollar spent on these programs by this analysis is ultra vires. It's beyond the law. The power to tax and spend for these purposes was just never delegated in the first place.
It radically simplifies the argument. It shifts the burden of proof entirely onto Congress to show how any massive social program relates specifically and directly to pro-debts or fighting wars using the 1787 definition of those terms.
Okay, let's pivot to the financial structure. Clause 2 and 56. The money fraud, borrowing, coining, counterfeiting. What was the fixed definition of money back in 1760?
The sources stress that money meant physical, coined metal, gold, or silver of a fixed weight and known value. The power to borrow was limited to taking temporary loans of existing specie repayable in the same form. The government could coin it, but it couldn't create it out of thin air.
And the sources use Madison's 1816 veto of the Second Bank to back this up. He said, "The power to borrow money is not a power to create money."
That distinction is paramount. The source claims that the power does not, under any circumstances, authorize the creation of fiat currency, irredeemable paper notes, or a central bank to manage this debt and currency system. And this brings the entire modern financial structure into question.
Which means the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 is claimed to be void ab initio. The legal tender acts that establish paper money as legal tender, they're also void by this logic.
They're cited as structural violations, resting on an assumed power. The argument is that the issuance of Federal Reserve notes, which are technically debt instruments, is outside the scope of Clause 5, coining, and Clause 2, borrowing.
And the most provocative link here is to Clause 6, the power to punish counterfeiting. How does that seal the argument?
Well, the source quotes Jefferson, and he said, "To emit bills of credit is to counterfeit money. The power to punish counterfeiting would be absurd if Congress could itself counterfeit." Oh. So if Congress, through its central bank, issues irredeemable paper or debt notes that are forced onto the economy as money, the government itself is engaged in the very fraud it claims to punish private individuals for committing. It makes the entire structure logically incoherent and void from the start.
That's a devastating claim. It's asserting that the very medium of exchange in the country is fundamentally based on an illegal act of usurpation.
It's intended to be. It strikes right at the heart of state fiscal power.
Let's tackle the clause used to justify nearly all modern regulation. Clause 3, the Commerce Clause expansion. What was the 1760 fixed definition of commerce in among?
Commerce strictly meant intercourse, traffic, or navigation. The physical movement of goods across borders. Regulate meant to smooth out obstructions, primarily to prevent states from imposing tariffs or tolls on one another, as stressed by Madison and Story. And crucially, among meant between the several states, not within them.
So the original intent wasn't to grant some general police power over every economic activity, but specifically to manage that interstate trade friction.
Exactly. The source argues that the clause does not grant power over local production, health, safety, labor standards, or general moral welfare. If the activity is local production, manufacture, or possession, even if the good eventually travels, it's not commerce among the several states in the 1787 sense.
Wow. This opens up a massive list of things claimed to be void. Give us the major examples of modern statutes this analysis says are void ab initio.
The list is extensive because nearly every regulatory agency rests on that modern, expanded definition of affecting commerce. The sources cite OSHA workplace safety rules, because that's regulating labor and production, which is intrastate. FDA drug approvers and safety standards, which is regulating health, a police power. CDC mandates, NLRB labor relations, and EPA emission standards. All of them.
And the conclusion is, because these are domestic police powers that were never delegated to the federal government, they are illegitimate extensions and structurally void.
They are extensions of power into the state's traditional sphere. The argument is simple. Every statute reading commerce is everything is a structural violation of the contract and therefore void ab initio.
Okay, let's look at clause 4. Uniformity and executive overreach, naturalization. The key word here is uniform.
In the 1787 context, uniform meant one fixed public statutory rule that's applied equally across all states for becoming a citizen. The founders were worried about states making citizens too easily, so they wanted a singular process. The sources cite Story, who affirmed that this demanded one fixed rule, leaving no discretion left to the states or to the executive.
So any law or policy that introduces variation or discretion is a violation of that uniformity requirement.
Correct. And this is why the source claims that discretionary, executive, or state-varying policies are void. Examples cited include DACA, which was an executive memo, TPS designations, which are executive fiat, allowing temporary non-uniform status, and chain migration as not being based on one fixed statutory rule.
And the source material even applies this logic to the bankruptcy powers within the same clause.
Yes. The original intent of bankruptcy power was primarily for insolvent traders, people involved in interstate commerce, to settle their commercial debts. Therefore, the modern application of bankruptcy or debt relief to non-traders, like for student loan forgiveness, is cited as exceeding the original narrow scope of the power.
Turning to the military.
Yeah.
Clauses 11, 12, 13. War, armies, and navy limitations. These clauses seem very specific, yet modern warfare looks nothing like it did in 1787.
And that's the challenge. The sources insist the fixed definitions must apply. Regarding declare war, clause 11, the power to commence hostilities is exclusive to Congress, and it requires a formal public declaration. Hamilton confirmed the president is commander-in-chief, but only Congress can start a war.
So void actions would be any use of force not preceded by a formal declaration.
Yes. The material cites the AUMFs from 2001 and 2002, drone strikes, and executive police actions that commence hostilities without a formal declaration as violating the fixed intent of clause 11, their assumed powers.
Okay, next, the check on a standing army. Raise and support armies, clause 12, has that strict 2-year appropriation limit.
This is a classic Republican check. Madison was emphatic that the 2-year limit was essential to prevent a standing army in peace. The intent was to force Congress to reauthorize the existence of an army every 2 years.
That raises a huge question about the modern defense apparatus, doesn't it?
It does. The source argues that permanent defense budgets, which extend beyond 2 years, the maintenance of a draft registration system in peacetime, and the funding of permanent overseas bases are all structural violations of that 2-year limitation. They claim these actions nullify the congressional check that was intended to prevent a permanent military-industrial establishment.
And Clause 13's limitation on the Navy seagoing vessels only.
This strictly authorizes the support and maintenance of a naval fleet for defense against invasion from the sea. By the 1787 definition, forces that operate predominantly on land or in the air were not included. Therefore, the creation and funding of the Air Force, the Space Force, and the use of specialized units like SEAL teams on land raids or the CIA paramilitary are cited as exceeding the fixed grant of power to provide and maintain a Navy.
Finally, let's look at the remaining limits. Clause 17 and necessary and proper, execution versus grant. Clause 17 grants exclusive legislative authority only over the 10-mile square district, D.C., and necessary military facilities like forts and arsenals.
This clause defines the geographic limits of federal general jurisdiction. The source argues that this power does not authorize the federal government to become the largest landowner in the nation. Therefore, vast federal holdings like national forests, BLM lands, and wildlife refuges are claimed to be unconstitutional usurpations because they aren't necessary to execute a military purpose or contained within the seat of government.
And the grand finale, the Necessary and Proper Clause, Clause 18. It's so often cited as the catch-all for federal power, but the source disagrees fundamentally.
It's defined as a rule of execution, not a grant of substantive power. Hamilton himself noted that the Constitution would operate precisely the same way if the clause were just obliterated. The critical analysis focuses on the fixed 1760 definitions of the words.
And what does necessary mean in that context?
It meant indispensable, absolutely required to carry out one of the 17 preceding powers. It did not mean merely convenient, helpful, or useful. And proper meant consistent with the letter and spirit of the grant. If the law is not indispensable to execute one of the enumerated powers, it is void.
So give us the void examples that fail that indispensable test.
Again, the source reiterates, the Federal Reserve Act is not indispensable to coining money. The EPA regulations, the Department of Education, and even foundational laws of the administrative state, like the Administrative Procedure Act. They argue these laws are merely convenient structures for usurped power, not indispensable means for executing the limited grants. The clause, therefore, it authorizes the mode of exercising granted powers, not the creation of new ones.
Okay, so we're going to shift now. We've been talking about the substance of the law, what Congress wrote. Now we turn to the form of the law, how Congress wrote and published it. This is the argument that much of the federal statute book is void, not for what it says, but because it failed to follow the rules for legitimate enactment.
This is the legal mechanics part of the argument, and it's arguably the most crucial to understanding the alleged jurisdictional blackout. The rule of law requires not just limited power, but precise, knowable, and legitimately authenticated law.
The source material lays out the constitutional requisites of statute, the mandatory structure for an authentic law. What are the three pillars?
They must have the title, the enacting clause, and the body. A violation of any of these is a formal defect, rendering the act void ab initio.
Let's focus on the first two. The title has to express the single subject matter, and it acts as a guard against fraud.
Historically, the title was essential to prevent stealth and fraud in legislation. It has to fairly apprise the people of the subject matter. If a bill titled to aid navigation secretly includes tax hikes on land transactions, the defect in the title renders the entire act void because the real intent was concealed from public view and debate.
But the enacting clause, that seemed to be the critical formal flaw the sources are citing regarding the modern code.
It is the ultimate test of jurisdictional identity. The enacting clause, be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, is the formal declaration of authority. It's the signature of the lawgiver.
And why is that naming convention mandatory?
It's rooted in centuries of common law. Every edict, from a king's decree to a colonial ordinance, had to explicitly name the source of its authority. An omission is a fatal jurisdictional defect. The source quotes legal maxims that say to strike out the enacting clause is to cut off the head of the bill, rendering it null and void because it shows no sign of authority to the public.
So for you, the listener, the idea is you should be able to look at the law you're being charged under and see that explicit constitutional authentication right on the face of the document.
Precisely. If you have to search through legislative history to prove the source, the law lacks authenticity and isn't legally binding. And this is the bridge the source uses to discuss the widespread mechanism of fraud, the usurpation of codes and non-positive law titles.
Okay, let's spend a minute here making the distinction between positive law versus non-positive law really, really clear. This is complex legal territory, but it's absolutely vital to the source's claim.
Okay, think of it this way. Positive law is the official original law that Congress actually voted on, enrolled, and the president signed. It retains the title and the enacting clause. Its text is legal evidence of the law itself.
So what about non-positive law?
Non-positive law refers to the majority of the current U.S. code, that massive compilation of federal law organized into 54 titles. These codes were organized by the Office of the Law Revision Council, which is just a committee within the House of Representatives. They are editorial compilations.
Yeah, so the U.S. Code, which is what citizens often look up, is basically a committee sorting files, not Congress actually legislating.
That is the structural claim. The source argues these non-positive titles are not law in and of themselves. They are merely prima facie evidence, which means they're presumed correct. But the government has to ultimately trace every line back to an actual original positive law statute with all the formal requisites intact.
And the alleged jurisdictional blackout happens because the compilers of the U.S. Code, in the process of tidying up the laws into these titles, they removed the crucial elements.
That's the fatal defect. The vast majority of the U.S. Code, particularly the regulatory titles, are stripped of their mandatory title and, critically, the enacting clause. The source claims that since these documents lack that constitutional authentication on their face, they are lawless and possess no force whatever.
So if the government is enforcing laws that lack a formal declaration of authority, what is it relying on?
Legal fiction. The fiction is that the citizen should just assume the law is properly enacted, even when the jurisdictional identity of the lawgiver is missing from the face of the document.
Let's look at how this applies to major aspects of federal control. What about Title 26? Internal Revenue Code, the basis for all IRS enforcement.
Title 26 is classified as non-positive law. The source claims that not only is the underlying enforcement mechanism void because it rests on that void fiat currency standard we talked about in Part 3, but the code itself is formally defective because it lacks the mandatory enacting clause and is just an editorial compilation, not a congressional enactment.
In Title 42, Public Health and Welfare, that title underpins Social Security, Medicare, and CDC FDA authority.
Title 42 is also non-positive. So the claim is twofold. Substantively, these programs violate Clause 1, General Welfare, since they're not common defense. And formally, they are enforced through an editorially compiled, stripped-down CURD that lacks the constitutional requisites. This is the systematic usurpation at the heart of the critique. Laws are being enforced that are merely a collection of words from some committee, not binding acts of legislation.
It's like the difference between following the director's cut of a movie and following a random transcript someone printed out that's missing all the credits and legal disclaimers.
Precisely. The argument is that the text is there, but the authority is missing.
This final section takes the critique of legitimacy one step further. We're moving beyond the substance of the law in the form of a law to challenge the status of the agents who are enforcing the law, the central claim. The bar license is a title of nobility, which is explicitly banned by the Constitution.
This is one of the most provocative structural challenges in the entire source material. Article 1, Sections 9 and 10 strictly prohibit the U.S. and the states from granting any title of nobility. The sources use St. George Tucker and Hamilton to define this broadly as any privilege, rank, or statutory grant that places one class of citizens above the common citizen.
And the bar license is classified as such a privilege.
Yes. The material argues the bar license is a statutory grant of exclusive privilege. Thomas M. Cooley defined a title of nobility as any privilege granted by statute, which gives one man an exclusive right over a trade or profession, such as the practice of law. The bar grants exclusive access to the courts, it controls the administration of justice, and it places the attorney in a privileged role, often over the unrepresented citizen.
The sources also point to the historical attempt to remove any kind of aristocratic element from government.
They cite the proposed original 13th Amendment from 1810, often called the Title of Nobility Amendment, which was ratified by 12 states before it was kind of lost to history. That amendment sought to disqualify any citizen who accepted a title of nobility from holding office. The very existence of this proposal reinforces the founders' intent to eliminate any special anti-Republican status.
What about the connection to foreign allegiance?
The source material focuses on the use of aristocratic honorifics. The term esquire, used by many attorneys, and the order of the coif, a common academic honor. They're direct descendants of the English Inns of Court under royal charter, which were aristocratic legal guilds. The sources argue these symbols and structures demonstrate a foreign allegiance and an aristocratic hierarchy that's just incompatible with the fixed republican structure.
So what is the staggering consequence of this claim?
The argument is that since almost all federal judges, prosecutors, and many members of Congress hold bar licenses, they have accepted a title of nobility. By accepting that privilege, the source claims they are self-disqualified from office under the constitutional ban. This leads to the self-dissolution of the guild government. Every resultant act, every judicial opinion, every indictment, every statute is claimed to be void ab initio because the agent was constitutionally disqualified.
That is a staggering claim. Okay, that the system is rotten, not just because of the laws it passes, but because of the very status of the people passing and enforcing them. So if everything is void, how does the source material propose a return to the fixed contract? They emphasize restoration, not rebellion.
The focus is strictly on nonviolent legal mechanisms to enforce the fixed contract.
Right.
Since every unconstitutional act is treason against the sovereignty of the people, the remedy is self-executing. The source references Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, asserting that officers enforcing void acts are automatically dissolved because they have engaged in insurrection against the fixed law.
But practically, how does a citizen who doesn't possess inherent governmental power enact this restoration?
The material details several tools. One is the concept of congressional notice. This is a specific formal legal instrument, often described as a 6-page demand, that is served upon Congress. It stipulates the constitutional violations and sets a 10-day deadline. And crucially, the doctrine asserts that silence or failure to rebut the claim within that deadline is treated as admission that the statutes cited are void.
And what about individual enforcement?
They propose affidavit templates for citizens to file in court or serve upon officials, declaring specific statutes void based on those firewall principles we established back in Part 1. The goal is to force the agent, the Congress, the judge, the prosecutor, to respond to the constitutional limits, thereby restoring accountability to the strict text.
And the final tool provided to you, the listener, is a simple test.
Yes, the one-page checklist. It distills this entire deep dive into two questions every citizen should ask of any enforcing statute. First, can this law be traced strictly to one of the 17 enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8, using the 1787 fixed definitions? And second, has this law been properly enacted as positive law, retaining its mandatory title and enacting clause? If the answer to either is no, the source instructs the citizen to treat the statute in their private and legal affairs as void ab initio.
The ultimate goal is to put the burden of constitutional proof back on the government, forcing its agents to demonstrate that they're operating within that fixed, knowable, written charter. So what does this all mean? We have undertaken an intense journey into a legal argument that asserts the entire post-New Deal federal apparatus is structurally illegitimate. This critique operates on two incredibly powerful connected prongs.
The first is the substantive violation of Article 1, Section 8. The claim is that virtually all modern regulatory, financial, and welfare legislation, from the Federal Reserve and fiat currency to Social Security and the EPA, is void because the powers were never delegated to Congress. And this all relies on a strict 1787 fixed definition of terms like money, commerce, and general welfare.
And the second prong is the formal violation. The argument is that even if the power were delegated, the laws themselves, compiled as non-positive titles in the U.S. Code, like the Internal Revenue Code, they lack the mandatory formal requisites, the title and the enacting clause, rendering them non-authentic and legally fictitious from the perspective of binding law.
The core message here is not one of political ideology, but of structural integrity. The source material argues, through the voices of Madison and Jefferson, that the rule of law is guaranteed only by clinging to the literal fixed letter of the parchment contract. Deviation, however convenient or popular, leads inexorably to the rule of men and thus tyranny. The only legitimate government is a simple, fixed, and knowable government.
The provocative thought this leaves you with is this. If the Constitution is truly a fixed, non-negotiable contract of limited delegation, and if the agents sworn to uphold it are indeed operating under laws that are, by this strict textualist definition, entirely null and void, what is the duty of the sovereign people? The question posed by this material is not how to peacefully reform a flexible system, but how to execute a systematic restoration of the original fixed contract when the legal agents have failed to police themselves. You are forced to consider what happens if the legal fiction that sustains modern governance were suddenly exposed.